to 9 p.m., the Corkscrew will be hosting a Spanish and Portuguese wine party to benefit the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Then on Saturday evening, local singer-songwriter Kate Hathaway will be playing from 8 to 10 p.m. Information at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about immigration reform. In January of last year, 2004, President Bush said that he would make immigration reform a priority in his second term and, among other things, talked about creating what would in effect be a guest worker program, making it possible for people who are here illegally to work legally. Some members of Congress have said that they are sympathetic to the concerns the president laid out and said they would work with him. And in fact, last month, proposed legislation that would indeed create a temporary worker program for undocumented workers. Other people in Congress, however, have taken a harder line and said, in fact, what we should be doing is we should tighten immigration rules, even for those people who are here legally. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll explore some of the issues surrounding immigration as we talk with Tamar Jacoby. She is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in Washington, D.C., where she writes and comments extensively on the issues of immigration, citizenship, and ethnicity. She is a journalist by her background. She's contributed articles and essays to a variety of publications, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The L.A. Times, The New Republic, to name a few. Before joining the Manhattan Institute, she was a senior writer and justice editor for Newsweek magazine. And before that, she was deputy editor of The New York Times op-ed page. And before that, she was assistant to the editor of The New York Review of Books. She's the author of the book Someone Else's House, America's Unfinished Struggle for Integration. That was published by Basic Books back in 1998. And more recently, she was editor of a book titled Reinventing the Melting Pot, The New Immigrants and What It Means to Be American. That book was published also by Basic Books, published last February of 2004, so February of last year. As we talk this morning, certainly questions, comments are welcome. People who are listening are invited to join the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many people as possible, keep things moving along. But of course, people who are listening are welcome into the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So in and around Illinois and Indiana, if you're listening over the air, or if you might happen to be listening on the internet, you also may use the toll-free line as long as you're in the United States, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Jacoby, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. The president, as I said, early last year, as he was talking about his priorities for his second term, he indeed did say that immigration reform was something that he thought was important and has been talking about this idea for a while now of creating what would in effect be a guest worker program. Now, obviously, there are a number of things that he has to be concerned about. On the international side, there's Iraq, and as far as domestic issues go, one of the things that he's invested a great deal of his personal time in this year has been Social Security. But having said that, as far as you know, and as you watch things in Washington there, in the Bush administration, is immigration, does it continue to be an important issue?
Well, you know how this president is. He's famous for having a few priorities and sticking to them strictly and following them in order and being very disciplined about it. I believe that immigration is one of his top priorities, but I think he has a schedule, and he's got some other things he wants to tend to first, with the idea that he will come around to immigration. But the good news is that Congress has picked up the ball in the meantime, and this really is an issue that has to be solved by Congress. So, you know, I'm not too worried about the president not being involved in the game at the moment, because we've got, as you mentioned, Senators McCain and Kennedy put a very interesting proposal on the table in May, and Senators Cornyn and Kyle are going to come up with what I think is also going to be a very interesting proposal in a couple of weeks. And there's a lot of congressional action. So I'm not too worried about the president. The president will have to get involved eventually, but mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily have to get involved now.
Well, let's talk about the scope of the problem, because while perhaps people disagree on solutions, I think that there is much more agreement on the problem, the problem being large numbers of undocumented individuals coming into the United States looking for work. And while we're putting significant resources into enforcing the border, I think that everyone would say that people who are being honest would say, look, this is a losing battle. We could put even more resources than we're doing now, and there's no way, because we have this very long border with Mexico, and there are a lot of individuals who want to come in the United States looking for work. There's simply no way we're going to be able to keep them out.
Well, there are a couple of things there to unpack. Yes, mm-hmm. the public is hungry for a solution, and rightly so. It's one thing to have 1.5 million, which is about the number of legal and legal who come every year, 1.5 million foreigners in our country every year in the country. It's another thing to have guaranteed illegality in our workplaces and our communities. That's unacceptable to people, and rightly so. It's bad for the immigrants. It's bad for us, for our moral fabric. It's bad for the businesses who aren't sure they're going to get the workers. It's bad for American workers who are undermined when these people aren't legal and can't bargain for decent wages and working conditions. So the illegality is really unacceptable. Can we get control? I believe, and the president believes, and the people, a range of congressmen from the president to Senator Kennedy believe that if we create legal channels, if we give the people who are coming to work a way to come legally, we can police it. What we've got now is the equivalent of prohibition. Our limits, our quotas are so low, so out of sync with our labor needs, that of course about 500,000 people are coming illegally, and that's unacceptable. But if we have legal channels that accommodate our labor needs, we can police them pretty effectively, as we police liquor licenses.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we need to make the point, and I'm sure it's something we no doubt will come back to, is the extent to which the American economy has come to depend on undocumented workers.
Well, and not necessarily in a bad way. Our workforce is getting older, more educated. People go to college now that used to hardly graduate from high school. I mean, we can talk about the numbers. And meanwhile, international trends and competition and technology are meaning that a lot of our businesses actually require more unskilled workers. They require, yes, more educated people, but also more uneducated people. And we don't have the people to do those jobs. So we need these workers from abroad. It's not a bad thing for us. It's a good thing that we happen to have a country next door or countries that can send us these workers when we don't have them.
How much are we spending now on in border enforcement in the effort to prevent people from coming in the United
States?
That's
a very good question, and I've lost track of the actual number. It's steadily rising. It's quintupled in the last decade. Exactly what the absolute amount is now, I've lost track of.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure
billions.
There was a significant.
Billions.
It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money.
What we don't do, though, we don't do it as effectively as we might. Again, we have these very unrealistic laws, and we know that they're unrealistic. So we don't throw up our hands. The authorities do their best, but for example, we don't have serious enforcement in the workplace, because we know that serious enforcement would mean basically hampering American economic growth. If we had a system that was more realistic, we could have that enforcement in the workplace, not draconian, not Orwellian, just reasonable compliance.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there still significant numbers of people in Congress who somehow would make the argument that the problem here, they acknowledge the problem that there are undocumented people in the United States, but who would say that this is a law enforcement problem, and that's the way to deal with it, either in the workplace, and that we ought to be tougher on people who employ undocumented workers, or again, going back to the issue of the border, that somehow we need to spend even more on border enforcement. Are there?
Sure, the battles. Yeah. I mean, the battle. Nobody's against enforcement. Everybody understands. Everybody understands the public hunger to get control. But the battle that's shaping up is basically the people who say enforcement only, or enforcement alone. And the people who say you can't have enforcement only, you have to have enforcement plus better laws. I mean, it, again, think about prohibition. Right now, we're in a circumstance like prohibition. Should we just throw all the money we've got at making prohibition stick, or should we get rid of prohibition and then spend some money on liquor licenses and import duties and stuff like that?
There is, as you say, there is a something of a bipartisan effort going on in the Congress, at least both Republicans and Democrats, putting forth ideas on how to deal with this. And then also, I'm sure other people would have different kinds of ideas. Can you talk a little bit about what has been put on the table by members of Congress?
Sure. The basic outline of the plan does go back to what Bush talked about in January 2004. And what you need is a guest worker program. That's, McCain Kennedy has a guest worker program. Corn and Kyle will have a guest worker program. And those are the legal channels. That's to get the labor we need. Then you need tough enforcement to back it up. But you also, and this is obviously the big political problem, you've got to do something about the 11 million illegal immigrants already here and working, people we depend on to keep our economy going, but who are illegal. And we're not going to send them home. I don't think anybody thinks that America as a country is going to round these people up and put them on trains. We're not going to, quote-unquote, starve them out, where we make life here so miserable for them that they go home by themselves. Very unlikely. A lot of them have businesses here and families and U.S. citizen children and have lived here 20 years. So what do we do with them? And sure, there's a moral quandary because we're talking about people who have broken the law. On the other hand, we need them. It's what the law they broke was not, we can talk about how serious it is. But if we're going to create this new legal system where the compliance with the law is the norm, we got to do something about them for our sake. So the McCain-Kennedy bill gives them a way to basically go on probation, to pay a fine, work for another 6 years, wait their turn to get in the back of the line for green cards, but eventually become Americans if they want to. But there are a lot of people who don't like that and say that that's rewarding illegal behavior, and that's where the real fight's going to be, or one of the biggest fights.
Well, I realize that here one has to be careful about making sweeping generalizations about parties and their positions on things. But generally speaking, I think people probably have the idea that Democrats tend to have a more open approach to the subject and Republicans tend to take a little bit harder line. Now, within the Republican Party, however, we know that there are people who are saying, we need to deal with it, and this is the way to deal with it, to acknowledge the fact that the economy needs these workers and create some way for people to come and work legally and also to do something about the number of people who are here illegal who are working. Then there are other Republicans who do take a harder line and I think have been critical of the president for not taking a harder line. So is how this gets worked out, does it come down to how within the Republican Party, how these two sides resolve their differences?
A lot of the fight will be within the Republican Party, not entirely, because there are also Democrats who worry about immigration. Who think it's not necessarily good for the country. So there's a fight on the left as well. And you can imagine in a moment when this would be a big accomplishment for the Bush administration, there are potentially generations of Latino voters at stake, voters who would vote for the party that solved it. There's some Democrats who don't want to give President Bush a big win on it. So there are divisions within both parties, but you are indeed right that the big battle will be within the Republican Party and on the right, because Republicans are split between people who see it's a problem, think that the best way, and driven by a lot of things, not just business. People want to put the economy on a sound footing, but there's also restoring the rule of law. Those Republicans who think that the best way to restore the rule of law and to get a grip on our security, which we haven't talked about, is to create a more rational, smarter system. So they're fighting the other Republicans who say enforcement only, law and order, let's be tough, and who are frightened of the immigrants. So it is going to be quite a battle on the right, I believe, in the next couple of years.
Well, that leads to maybe one more question, talking about the politics, and then we can come back and maybe look at some of these issues in a little bit greater depth, but that it has to do with the fact that there are an awful lot of issues on the agenda in Congress, and next year is an election year. So I think the question they raise is whether much significant will happen on this issue at all, probably within the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's a fair question, and if I knew, my life would be a lot clearer. But there is a hunger in the public for dealing with it. You see that in things like the Minutemen exercise on the border in Arizona. You see it in local voting issues. You see it in people are fed up with the illegality, especially in border states, but not only in border states. You know, on Long Island, where there's been a big increase in immigrants. I mean, there's no part of the country that doesn't have immigrants now. So wherever there's a big increase, people are upset by the illegality, and they want it solved. And I think that hunger is making itself felt. It's pushing up from below, making itself felt in Congress. And that's why you're seeing a lot of Congress people trying to step up to the plate and do something about it. Whether they will manage to make it, you know, it will be a big, when it happens, it will be a big national battle, something like the battle over the NAFTA Accords. You know, will this hunger translate into that kind of battle in the next year? It may not. So it may take a couple of years, but it may happen sooner than that.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Tamar Jacoby. She is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in Washington, D.C., and writes and comments on issues of immigration and citizenship. She is a journalist by her training. She worked at Newsweek magazine. She's also been on staff at the New York Times. She was deputy editor of the op-ed page of the Times and also worked at the New York Review of Books. Her most recent book, a book that she edited, is titled Reinventing the Melting Pot, The New Immigrants and What It Means to Be American. It was published by Basic Books in February of 2004. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a second, why don't we also take up the issue of Homeland Security, because that now complicates immigration, the whole discussion about immigration, to a degree that it probably would not have before 2001. How does introducing that into the mix make things more complicated?
Well, imagine this. Think a minute about the circumstance we have now, where hundreds of thousands of people walk across the border every year with no papers, no background checks, probably using fake names. We don't know where they're going to go, and we don't know that they're in the country, who they are, and where they're going to go in the country. If they showed up on an international watch list in 6 months, we wouldn't know where to go and find them. Wouldn't it be better to let these people come in an orderly way, not walking over the border, but through the port of entry? We'd take their fingerprints, maybe. We'd do some background checks on them. We'd get addresses where they're going to live, and think how much better that would be for our security than the circumstance we have now. But in order to do that, we need to create these legal channels, a guest worker program. I mean, I'll never forget the border immigration service inspector, really, he was, 30-year veteran of the service. I interviewed him in Arizona last year in his office down there on the border with his, he'd been a Vietnam vet, and he had his Purple Heart and his Bronze Star, a real patriot, been defending this country for 30 years. And he said, if another 9/11 happens, and it happens on my watch, somebody walks across here in this stretch of Arizona border that I'm in charge of, because I was so busy chasing your next busboy or your gardener, I don't know how I'll be able to live with myself. And I think that kind of sums it up. Those guys want to get to work chasing the terrorists, not chasing my next busboy or gardener.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation to start us out, and that's someone listening in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi there. I've got just a question and I'll hang up. How much of the people in the United States' anger or concern is based on racism?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And, of course, no one knows. I don't actually believe that the majority is. I think, of course, there are people out there who are just plain old bigots. I think there are a lot of other concerns that feed in that can get confused with bigotry. I think there are a lot of people who are worried about our quote-unquote culture. And I don't think that's necessarily the same as bigotry. If I thought that in 20 years we were going to be a country where Spanish was as much of the language as an equal language with English, where we'd adopted Mexican authoritarian political values instead of our own, where we'd given way to Latino fatalism instead of our can-do spirit, I'd be worried too. I don't think any of that's going to happen. But that's a worry about the culture, not so much about race. And it's easy for people to confuse that with race. And I think it's easy even to confuse the concern about the illegality with bigotry. But I think bigotry is a small part of it. The concern about the culture is a much bigger part.
Of the questions, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. As the members of Congress talk about what it is that might be done, and again, I'm thinking about those people who are advocating for a harder line approach, it seems that when there are kind of two basic parts to this. One is if we acknowledge the fact that we need the workers and that there are people who want to come here to work, we could create a program to do that. However, we do then have this issue of the people who are here now. And I think that one of the concerns that people have is that by granting them an amnesty, we would be sanctioning or turning a blind eye to an illegal act that is coming here illegally and being here illegally. I mean, is it if we're going to do the overall thing, if indeed the thing is to create this guest worker program, then do we have to say, well, We're just going to acknowledge the fact that some people broke the law in coming here, and we're going to say there's nothing we can really do about that at this point, and say if now you'll follow the rules, we're not going to prosecute you for being here illegally.
Well, I think there are a couple of things. I mean, we don't just want to say never mind. We do want to, at the very least, make them pay some kind of penalty, make them jump through some kind of hoops. We don't just want to reward illegal behavior. I think that's a legitimate concern. But I think what the public's actually really upset about is I think people understand the concept of a second chance. That's a very American concept. I mean, they broke the law, but there is, it's very hard to do it legally. There is really no line to get it. You wait 7 years, 20 years for a visa if you wait the normal way. So I think people are understanding of the idea of give these people a second chance to do it the right way, to pay a penalty and then do it the right way. What people are afraid of is that really we don't have the system under control. And they're afraid this is going to be one amnesty in a long line of amnesties, that we have to do that every couple of years. And that bothers people, and understandably so. We don't want a system that's so nonsensical and nudge, nudge, wink, wink that the rules don't mean anything, and we got to pretend every couple of years we got to say the people who broke them, it doesn't matter. So I think if Congress can come up with a system that really is airtight and really does work and it's backed up by enforcement, and we're going to replace this nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing, this hypocrisy, with a system where we have rules and people stick by them, then I think people can get over a one-time transitional thing where we say to these people, you're going to get a second chance.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also there are some people who had raised this question. If you take a look at the system that we have now and the people who are here legally and the long and tortuous path that they have to go through to become American citizens, that we got a lot of problems with this system that we have now. And if we added in this 500,000 people who are here, 11 million, if we add in all the people who are here illegally and who might indeed then decide, if we created this program, made it possible to come here, no telling what sort of number that we have here, this is an administrative issue. This would be a staggering sort of new problem. And given how the system works now, either well or poorly, depending on what kind of word you want to use, it's not a small thing that we're talking about.
No, that's fair. And the backlogs are unbelievable. The snafus are unbelievable. Nobody thinks the system works. But part of the reason it doesn't work is because it's a system where we kind of know that we don't follow the rules and the rules don't matter, and it's this nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing, and so we don't appropriate the right kind of money. But, you know, in the wake of 9/11, with U.S. security at stake, with a real commitment to fix this, it won't be easy. I'm not saying it will be easy, and making the enforcement work won't necessarily be easy either. But I think, what's the alternative? To just say, well, the house is such a mess, let's burn it down? I don't think so. I think you have to clean it up.
Hmm. Well, what sort of ideas have people put forward as a way of what you're going to have to do is at least know and be able to keep track of the number of people who are here under such a program, where they're living and what they're doing and so forth?
Well, the key thing is to be able to verify that, that people who get hired are authorized to be hired. If we can create a system where bosses, employers, really know whether or not their work, the people that they're hiring are legal or illegal, that's really the key to it. And, you know, the metaphor I use is imagine if you went in to buy a shirt and you gave the man in the store your credit card, and he eyeballed your MasterCard, no photo. Then he looked at you, and he said, well, I can't. This MasterCard looks like a legit MasterCard. I'm not really sure. It could be a forgery, but it looks like a legit one to me. And then he looked at you, and he said, well, you look like the kind of person who pays your bills. I'm not sure, but you kind of look like that. And then he said, well, if I'm wrong, I'm going to have to swallow the cost, the businessman. That's the circumstance we have now for employers. They look at these cards. They have no way of telling whether the cards are forged or not. They can't ask too many questions. And if they're wrong, they've committed a crime. We've got to fix that. We've got to give them a way to really tell whether the people they're trying to hire are legal or not. And I think it should be with a, you know, something like credit cards, a swipe card system, and they should get back an answer that the government's responsible for. This person is authorized to work or not. And then follow that up with penalties for the people who break the law. But most employers would rather be on the right side of the law with this. Big American companies who are the people who hire the majority of immigrants, Tyson, food processing, agriculture, big hotels, they don't want an illegal workforce. So let's give employers a way to figure out whether the employers, the employees they hire are legal or not. And I think that's the key to getting control. Hmm.
And then I think that takes us back to the discussion, the larger discussion we were having about security, however, because I think that there are some people who worry that if we create this ID card system for guest workers, that nudges us just a couple of steps closer to the idea of a national ID, which some people argue would be good for purposes of national security, and other people argue would be problematic for a variety of reasons. I mean, do those two things get tangled up, and does that make it more difficult to talk about what we do just for guest workers?
It makes it somewhat more difficult, but I'm not sure. I think in the wake of 9-11, first of all, I don't think you need a national ID. I think you could do this with a variety of different cards. For example, I could offer the employer my driver's license. You could offer them your Social Security card, and someone else could offer them a green card. They don't all have to be the same card. So, you know, let's make sure as we build the system that it doesn't call for one card. But I think in the wake of 9-11, you know, we all use cards. I mean, how many times do you show somebody a card every day? How many times do you swipe a card every day? I mean, I do it half a dozen times more. You know, to get into my gym, I have to swipe some kind of card. To get into the office building, I have to show some kind of card. You know, we're all getting pretty used to showing our cards. So, you know, I'm not sure we can't make this work. This is a huge part of our economy. This is something like a tenth of our economy. We ought to be able to, you know, figure out a system to make it legal.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here, someone on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had a couple comments. One is I think that a good deal more of the concern about illegal immigration is due to racism than you seem to suggest with the previous caller's question. And to assume that American culture is European American culture is to deny there's many, many Mexican Americans have been living in this country. In fact, they had California before we took it from them. Mexican American culture is a very big part of American culture, just as is African American culture and many other co-cultures. And so to assume that European American values and European American culture is the gold of American culture, I think, is a real problem.
Yeah, I'm not saying that American culture is European. What I'm saying is that there is a distinct difference. If, you know, you spend any time on the border area is kind of blended, but, you know, Mexico is a very different country than the United States, not because we're European, but because we're American. We have a very different political system. We have a very different class system. We have very different opportunities for people at the bottom. You know, most of them better. Most of those things, in my view, we do better than they do in Mexico. Mexico has some things to offer.
But I agree,
it's not that I'm saying we have to be more like France. I'm saying we want to stay like America. And sure, Mexicans will add some good things, too. But I think what people fear is some kind of general blending and, you know, if you will, backsliding on our part. But I don't think that's happening. I think Mexicans who come here, if they decide to stay, they very quickly understand, you know, they don't have to bribe the cops here, and they like that a lot better. And you know what? That's the rule of law. That's our political system. They like it. They become patriotic. They want to become American.
Right, but there are already millions of Mexican Americans that are a part of this culture.
Of course.
Southern California, it's huge. The United States is the fifth largest Spanish-speaking nation in the world.
Yeah, but those Mexican Americans are a lot more they're a lot more American now than they are Mexican.
Well,
I mean, we are very absorptive.
It's a blend, and that's a good thing.
I agree.
Okay, I think that's a real serious issue. And the other question I have is, if you're going to penalize the worker, would you also have a fine or a penalty for the employers who have been employing illegal immigrants for many, many years? And most of those businesses do know that they are illegal immigrants. They depend on that. They don't have to pay them hardly anything, and they don't have to offer them benefits.
Well,
so if you're going to penalize the worker, it seems to me you also need to penalize the businesses, the employers, who have been using them for all of these years.
I think the thinking is that going forward, employers who broke the law would be subject to stiff penalties, like really serious penalties. But that now, if most of these employers, big employers, do look at cards and go through a very elaborate system of looking at the cards and writing down the numbers and keeping track of them, they're basically put in a position where it's very hard for them to know. I mean, some of them, you know, Tyson, we do prosecute big companies that we think are, you know, willingly broken the law. But if you look at a forged Social Security card, write down the number, fill out the form, send that Social Security number to the government, but you are not allowed to ask the person holding the card questions or really scrutinize it, it's hard to penalize people for that. I think let's set up a new system. I mean, I think all this backward. Now let's get it right going forward.
What's your estimate of the number of employers who knowingly employ illegal immigrants because they can't get anybody else to do those jobs for that amount of money and with no benefits?
I think people know that they have illegal workers, but it's hard for them to find out. Again, you get shown a social, I mean, I don't know if you've gotten hired recently. Everybody has to give cards. Employers keep their forms called I-9s. Everybody who gets hired fills one out. You write down these numbers. You look at the cards, but you're not allowed to ask people a lot of questions. That's considered discriminatory. So the employers are kind of at the mercy of these fake cards.
I guess I don't believe that truckers keep two sets of books. Employers, they may have all the forms that they need to have so that they can demonstrate that they have tried to ascertain who's legal and who's not, but that doesn't mean that they don't know that they are hiring illegals and that they can therefore pay them much less and not offer them benefits and basically exploit them. I mean, the fact that we have forms and that they keep forms does not mean that those folks do not knowingly take advantage of that significant labor force.
And let's fix that. We're agreed.
And how would we do that then? Would we penalize?
Create a system where the cards weren't forgeable and where you swiped them and you got right back in real time. The Social Security Administration can tell if four people are using the same card, one person in Maine and one person in Illinois and one person in Arizona, Social Security system knows that right away. And they also know what's not a real number, and they know when a name doesn't match a number. Let's use that information. Right now we don't use it.
I think the bigger problem is that the American economy, as you said, depends upon a cheap labor force that it doesn't have to provide benefits for. And until you fix that need, not solve the problem.
And if these people, first of all, you know, let's take meatpacking. Yes, meatpackers used to get $20 an hour. It was a skilled job. It used to happen mostly in the Midwest. Now it happens mostly in Arizona, and sure, one of the things is that they don't have, you know, organizing is different. They don't have unions in Arizona as much, or not in Arizona, Arkansas, Nebraska. But the real thing that's changed the industry is competition from abroad and mechanization. So now instead of a skilled guy who carves up a carcass goes by on a conveyor belt, and a guy who makes $5.15 an hour just makes one stab in it, one cut. It's a very different kind of work, and it's much more low-paying. But it's what's made it low-paying is not that these people are illegal. What's made it low-paying is that the competition from abroad and the mechanization has changed the industry. Now, we could just, meatpacking and agriculture could move to other countries. If we didn't have the labor, meatpacking and the hogs and the cattle farming could move to Mexico, China, Brazil, other countries. I don't think that would necessarily be better. I think it should get decided by the market. But right now, the businesses would rather stay here, but they do need this less skilled worker in order to stay here. If we gave that less skilled worker a way to come legally, he could bargain for the best wages he could get. They wouldn't go back up to $20, but they would go up to whatever an American could get for the same work. He could join a union. All kinds of things could happen. Let's put it on a rational footing. And maybe at that point it would get more expensive and the business would decide to move to Brazil. That's possible. If the businessman was paying the real cost instead of not paying the health care or whatever, he might decide it wasn't worth it to do it here and move to another country. But right now we're not even allowing the market to make those decisions fairly because all this is happening in the black market.
I'm going to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're moving into our last 15 minutes, and I have a couple of other people I want to bring into the conversation and also should introduce again our guest for anybody who has tuned in here in the last 10 or minutes or so. Tamar Jacoby is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in Washington, D.C. She writes and comments on immigration and citizenship, among other issues. Before joining the Manhattan Institute, she worked as a senior writer and justice editor for Newsweek magazine. She's contributed articles to a number of publications, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, LA Times, New Republic, and others. She is the editor of the book Reinventing the Melting Pot, The New Immigrants and What It Means to Be American. The book was published by Basic Books in February of last year. And we're talking about immigration and immigration reform. We have several callers here in line ready to go. Callers can help us by trying to be brief, and that way we can get in as many as possible. Next caller up is calling from Herrick on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. There's two fundamental formulas that seem to affect how people feel about this. The first one is the wealth of the nation is the sum of the population times the resources times the education. And if you're far enough up on the ladder to take advantage of that, the more people here, the better. But the average wealth of the individual is the resources of the nation times your education divided by the population. So the fewer people, the better if you're further down the line. And it's just, you know, kind of a basic item here that the fewer people there are here to divide up the resources, the better their average income is going to be. And you talk like jobs leaving the United States is a really bad thing. It's a bad thing if there's not somebody to fill those jobs. But if those jobs are leaving because we don't have the people to do those jobs, it's a great thing because those jobs that will leave tend to be the lower valued jobs. I come from a very small town in Midwestern Illinois. And at one time during the recession, there were a lot of people here that were cutting firewood for a living, and they were making $25-$30 a day. Well, since that time, the value has gone up, the availability of jobs have gone up, and now there's hardly anybody around that you can get to cut firewood, and it's going to cost quite a bit more to have it. I don't think it's a bad thing that the people that were making $25 a day are now working at a better factory job and they're making 50 or 60 a day and they've got some benefits and things like that. So a lot of us in the United States don't feel that losing those jobs on the bottom rung is such a terrible thing.
See, that's not my experience. As I watch the public debate, I see people get very anxious when the jobs go. And, you know, I'm not a population expert, but my understanding is the countries that are losing population are all really worried about it. Japan, Europe, countries. I think it's hard to grow a business without workers. It's hard to defend your country without soldiers. It's hard to countries that are losing population are all worried about it.
But what you're talking about.
And when business moves abroad, people seem to get really upset about it. Any kind of business, you know. Sure, you don't. We don't want to be a country if people cutting wood. We do want high productivity jobs, and we want educated people, and we want to move up that ladder as a country as much as we can. But the point is that you can't. All the jobs are not going to be like that. There are going to be other kinds of jobs too that we need to sustain. In order for you to go to work as an electrical engineer, you know, as an IT engineer, you need to have somebody cutting your grass for you.
But you seem to be missing the point, because you're on that upper level. The people at the lower level say, I have certain skills, and why aren't my skills as valuable as other skills? And let's take the guy mowing the grass. If there weren't enough guys to mow the grass to go around, the people that had that skill, were really good at it, and could mow really quickly, wouldn't be making a good wage. They wouldn't be making, $2 an hour as a undocumented worker. They'd be making $30 or $40 an hour. And at that point, you, as a well-paid engineer, have to make a decision. You have to say, does my yard need to be mowed every week to this level, or should I re-landscape in some other method?
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily better. I don't have such a stake in a lower population that I think that's better. I think it's fine for people to have yards and have people to cut them. The point is that what's missing from this equation is what's happening to the American workforce. In 1960, half of American men dropped out of high school and went into the unskilled labor force. Today, about 10% of American men drop out of high school and go into the unskilled labor force. So, and it's just 40 years ago, 45 years ago. So we had a whole different kind of economy then, with lots of people to do things like mow lawns and work in meatpacking plants and work on farms and things like that. We don't have those people anymore, and we still need somebody to do some of that work. And maybe some of it we can do without. Again, if we had legal channels and employers had to pay full freight, they might decide, better to mechanize some of the things get mechanized. I can't quite imagine the mechanized busboy or the mechanized, whatever, but nurse's aide.
But the point is,
but we can mechanize some of it, but I don't think...
You're missing the point entirely, though. The point is that the busboy job become mechanized. It's that the busboy job become recognized, that it's considered to be a valuable thing, and that it is paid for what it's, a person is paid a good wage to make that, and that you let undocumented workers in to dilute the value of that job is what runs the price of that job down. And yes, I know prices for some things will go up. Prices for other things, a lot of jobs would probably go offshore. But the point is, the people in the United States would not become unemployed because the jobs went up. The people in the United States would have a higher standard of living because all jobs would be more valuable that are here.
Yeah, see, I think you're missing the point. I think your model is like living in a little Italian village surrounded by mountains and not trading with the village next door, pretending that the only goods that you had, the only resources you had, were the things that you could produce in your own village and not trading. We're saying this is a global market for labor, and let's get the benefits of that trade.
I'm going to jump in here again. I want to thank the caller for his comments. I think we've kind of exhausted the point. We've got about 7-8 minutes left and other callers, and so let's get on with some others and go next to Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to make a few comments, but I guess I'll just jump off on that last comment that was made by your guest. We're not like a little Italian village in the middle of the mountains. We're a country that's part of the whole world and has centuries and centuries long relationship with Mexico. So what I'm trying to say is that there are some assumptions that have come through in this program, and frankly, I really like this program, but I'm a little disappointed with this guest and how she hasn't really been challenged. And there are some assumptions as if Mexico is a whole other world. There have been these, to try to sum up Mexican political history as referring to Mexican authoritarian values and Latino fatalism, and then paint a picture of Spanish being a major part of the United States as some assumed horrible thing, and then say that there isn't racism going on here is disingenuous, I think. I mean, maybe that's really what you think, but that's not actually what's happening. I mean, I just hope that the listeners, and I'm sure many will, kind of question some of these values. We have NAFTA, so so the companies can come and go from the United States very easily. But at the same time, we want to make the people, we want to put a big blockade to the people coming through. When all the time that we're talking about this, the companies, the large major companies want this, want people to come here because they know that our economy needs the workers that come from Mexico. Not just want some, they're not here because it's nice to cut our lawns. Absolutely necessary to the U.S. economy and encouraged by the largest companies in the United States. And there are a lot of assumptions. There are other assumptions like that that have been kind of assumed in this discussion today that I just hope the listeners take into account. And not the least of which I'll end with, is that almost every single person listening to this broadcast, unless most African Americans and Native Americans, is a son or daughter, granddaughter, grandson of an immigrant. And most of them didn't come here with their papers all in order. Amnesties have been going on in the United States for 200 years. So to have another one is it's par for the course, and it's the least that can be done.
I don't think we disagree as much as you think. I think Mexico is a wonderful country. I spend a lot of my time in Mexico. I think Mexicans are going to be great for America. But I do think Mexico and America are two different countries, and we don't want to blend them. That, sure, Mexican-Americans are going to be some mix of the two, and they're going to bring a lot of the good things about their culture here. But I think there's a reason why they come, frankly. And I think they know it as, and it's partly to make money, but I think they very quickly appreciate our democratic values, our culture. They're just, again, our the opportunity. It's what people have always come to America for. There's a kind of opportunity here that there isn't in Mexico, and that's something we should be proud of. We don't have to be so relativistic. We can appreciate them and say there's some good things about Mexico, but we don't have to be so relativistic that we say that we don't have anything that's special. We do have some things that are special, particularly the equality of opportunity and our democratic values. So, I'm not apologetic about thinking that those things, that we've got some good ideas there that other countries haven't figured out quite as well. But that doesn't mean I think it doesn't mean I don't value a lot about Mexico and again, spend a lot of my time there. You're right.
You're a skilled journalist and a smart person because you try to change the focus into whether there's good things in the United States and good things about the United States. Of course there are. But the fact is, and I've been to Mexico many times and lived there for a while, and I worked with Mexican immigrants and lived with Mexican immigrants for about 15 years. There's one overriding reason that makes up about 90 to 95 or 99% of why Mexican people come here. It's not the weather.
To work.
It's not the wonderful strip malls and all that.
It's to work. We know that.
It's not just to work. It's to survive.
Well, okay, good point. Our system makes it possible.
We do disagree. It's not just to get a better job or have more opportunities. It's to survive. It's to not starve. It's so that when your child gets sick, you can take them to a doctor. It's so that you can have clean drinking water. It's so that your whole family can have shoes.
Okay, well, I rest my case.
That's not this political decision based on a balancing of what's good about the U.S.
I rest my case. That's because our economy works. Theirs doesn't. That's because our economy
would go back right now if they could, if economics let them do it.
Again, I rest my case.
If we had an agreement instead of like NAFTA, if we had something more like the EU, where the people actually can, along with the companies, the people were allowed to move back and forth between the countries, not just the companies allowed to move freely between the over the borders, then we'd have a whole different, it just reflects a whole different worldview. Right now, I believe you that you don't think that we disagree that much, but I think we do.
The kind of system I'm arguing for is a system that would allow them to go back and forth. I think some of them, lots of them, will eventually still decide that they want to be Americans. I think a lot of them will say the best opportunity for my kids is here. But my life doing is trying to create a system where they can go back and forth. As for the bigotry of Americans, just to go back to that, I've spent a lot of time in focus groups, behind that one-way mirror, listening to people talk about immigration, studying the polling out there on shows like this, talking to people about immigration. There are bigoted people. There is no question. But most Americans, I believe, buy into the idea that we're a nation of immigrants, and that it's that immigrants are hardworking people that ought to be that if, as long as they're not bad for our economy, ought to be given a chance. There's who can really tell about bigotry? It's one of those things that's pretty hard to plumb. But what I see is concern about the illegality, concern about control, concern about the culture, but I don't think most Americans are bigoted anti-immigrant.
I'm going to have to jump in here, and I really need to apologize. We have a couple of callers we can't take. All I can say is this is not the last show we will do on this subject, and we'll look for some other guests to who have different viewpoints we can have on future shows. You can hear them and make your comments as well. But for the moment, we will have to say thanks to our guest, Tamar Jacoby. She is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in Washington, D.C., writes and comments on issues like immigration and citizenship. She's the editor of a book titled Reinventing the Melting Pot, The New Immigrants and What It Means to Be American, that was published by Basic Books in February of 2004. Ms. Jacoby, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Horeen's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horeen's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll be talking about the nature of fame and what happens after. Historian Iris Chang once observed that celebrities are really distractions for the general public, first created, then most often destroyed, consumed for our amusement. Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn, the host, will be talking about what happens when your 15 minutes are up. Journalist Jeff Gwynn, co-author of the book The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame, will be talking with Celeste following the 1 o'clock news. The program itself gets underway with usual mix of news and sports and weather and other things at noon, and then you can hear the interview coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. As usual, Celeste Quinn will be hosting the program. Coming up in the second hour of this show, Focus 580, we'll be talking about American dominance around the world, but not military dominance. We'll be talking about culture and, more importantly, commercial dominance. Our guest for the program, historian Victoria DeGrazia, and we'll be talking about her recent book, Irresistible Empire, in which she looks at the ways that America's consumer-oriented capitalism changed life in Europe. Basically over the post-war era, but even going back further. She'll be joining us in the next part of Focus 580, so I hope you can stick around. Coming up here very shortly, though, we will have news. That's at 1 minute past the hour. Before that, an update on the commodity market, so please stay tuned.
And looking at the Chicago Board of Trade right now, we see that July wheat is down a half at 331 and a half. September at 342 is unchanged. July corn, 231 and three quarters, up one. September, 240 and a half, up three quarters. December, 251 and a quarter, up one and a quarter. Make that